Hi there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and this is my podcast. And before we get started, some words about the audio picture today. So I'm on the way to things getting better, but before that happens, they're getting a little worse. I've just put in a new analog mixer and mic on advice of my sound engineer, and it's sensitive enough that it's found some new hums in my office, which we're still trying to run to ground. In addition to that, one of my neighbors appears to have decided to build an ark, judging from all the hammering, which you will probably hear thanks to this wonderfully sensitive microphone. And my wife is working out of my office today, so you might hear her furious typing. She does 180 words or something. It's kind of like a machine gun in the background. So what news apart from the audio? Well, I've just finished Knights of the Rainbow Table last week, and just in time, because Charlie Strauss has sent me the first volley of Rapture of the Nerds, the novel that we're writing together. And that's what I'm going to be working on for the next 3 or 4 months, I suppose. In the day that I had free in between, I had a really nice idea for a little kid's book, an illustrated kid's book called The Night the Monsters Came to Dreamland. It's the second time I've had a picture book idea, and I've written it up, sent it off to my agent. The first one didn't really go anywhere. We'll see if this one goes further. It's pretty fun to do as an exercise anyway. And that's pretty much all the news. I'm in a bit of a rush today because I've got to go and have my hip looked at by the surgeon who did the surgery as part of the regular follow-up. And I also have to work on this thing with Charlie, and I have to do my physiotherapy in the pool, and it's just going to be a busy kind of day. So with no further ado, I'm going to jump into part two of Knights of the Rainbow Table. Cooling took priority. When Tracy came back, it was a minor pump problem that we'd all fixed a dozen times, and it was mostly just a matter of knowing where to kick and how hard. She said, "Why rainbow tables?" Two reasons. First, they are cool, and second, they parallelize. That was the kicker, parallelization. A parallelizable problem is one that can be worked on in lots of different places, because no step relies on the output from a previous step. Think of stuffing envelopes with friends. One group of friends can address envelopes, another can fill them, a third can run them through the postage meter. That's pretty parallelizable. If you finish with the meter before the stuffing group is done, you can grab a stack of metered envelopes and start stuffing, too. In theory, one slow doofus won't leave a room full of people sitting around, fuming. Now compare that with a serial task, like assembling a jet engine on an assembly line. First, Alice screws on one dingus, then Bill attaches a dingus to that, and Carol attaches a dingus to that, and so on, all the way to Zeke fitting the cowling at the other end of the assembly line. If Alice had a wild night last night and is dragging her ass as a result, Bob, Carol, and the rest, yea unto Zeke, are going to be stuck with their thumbs firmly planted up their elementary canals. It might be possible to redesign a jet engine factory to run with more parallel tasks. Think of the famed Japanese car companies where small teams assemble whole cars, where one team's drag-assing doesn't hold up the factory. But there's a lot of computation where the next step depends on the previous one. And the more of that there is, the less you can do with a big parallel cluster. Of course, there's always some extent to which problems are serial. If there's one guy who's really slow with the address labels, eventually you're all going to be sitting around waiting for him to finish off his sheet, looking meaningfully at your watches and trying to figure out when the last bus goes. The shithouse was full of computers who were basically that guy. We didn't discriminate when it came to the rescue animals we took in, nursed to health, and set to productive use. The basements and dorm rooms and storage lockers of Berkeley vomited forth a steady stream of junk hardware, stuff that the granuloid masses couldn't bear to send to landfill. Every time CNN showed another expose featuring blistered and goitered Chinese kids laboring over acid vats to strip apart e-waste, we got a fresh shipment of guilt and shame and obsolescence. Combine that with the screaming doubling curve that computer power rides and you got our shelves, where a given computer might be quite literally a million times faster than its neighbor, and like as not, it would be consuming a tenth of the problem. Talk about eco-guilt. We were a one-building carbon crime wave. We had heterogeneity for days, and with that Selma Gundy came any number of chewy, interesting clustering problems. Which computer should be in charge of working, translating passwords into hashes? Which computer should be in charge of apportioning work? How do you index what's on which computer, and what do you do about recovering a computer's lost work when it dies? Should more common worth be stored on faster computers, or more computers, or both? Or does figuring out which password to put where cost more than we'd save just by dumping passwords into computers at random? These are meaty and interesting subjects, and we waged arguments back and forth and up and down about them and wrote feverish code to prove our points of view, and we never got around to writing up any papers for publication, though we sure started plenty. We could have had an ACM journal dedicated to us, the Journal of Incomplete Research into Distributed Computing. The Rainbow Tables project had been up and running for a month when Tristan called me from work. He had a wage slave gig fine-tuning some semi-fraudulent search engine optimization tools at a doomed Oakland startup where he was, get this, the best adjusted programmer on staff. I'm thinking of worm trails or ant trails or something like that, he said. Nice to hear from you too, Tristan, I said. We didn't use phones for voice calls much, various IMs being much cleaner, cryptographically sound, and suited to multitasking. But sometimes Tristan needed to say things aloud to make sure he knew them, but his phone manner was dreadful. So when you look up a password, you just ask a random computer, and if it doesn't have it, it asks another random computer, and so on until it finds the password. Then the computers with the password tells the next computer, and it tells the next, and the next, and the next, and they all store the passwords, like a pheromone trail, like ants. So the more you ask for a password, the more available it becomes, the more pathways there are to it, like. It gets more robust the more you use it. Plus, we'll be able to see which passwords are commonest over time because the network will evolve to match them. I could hear the spittle flying. He was on a roll. And he was right. Tracy saw it right away and helped me with a formal proof. But before I'd even finished that, Tristan was coding it, Tracy was debugging it, and I was writing test cases for it. And you know what? It worked. Muskowski sends us email in the clear, no encryption. He relies on the security of his home and office networks and interconnections between his ISPs and ours to protect and secure our communications. Muskowski hasn't figured out yet that all that stuff is an open book. Or if he's figured it out, he hasn't felt it in his guts or his blood or his balls or wherever you need to feel a hard truth before you really know it. I'm still looking for a technical expert, someone I can put on the stand who can explain the socially beneficial aspects of your work. None of the names you suggested have panned out. This is important, guys. It sure would have helped if you'd published or given some learned presentations at big conferences or something. I want to put you in front of the judge as noble security researchers who worked in the service of a better world, but I can only do that if I can find someone other than you to say it. The conversation that transpired afterwards is encrypted to a nicety, because we know that passwords are a dead letter. You see, one day our cluster got so big that we could factor every single password that a human being could remember, every phrase, every nonsense string, up to 1,000 characters. Now, somewhere out there a Memnus freak or stage performer can do better than that, but he probably doesn't have any secrets worth keeping. Getting the shithouse to that scale required discipline. At a certain point, we needed to actually go around and pull the plug on a lot of old-school gear, rescind our all-comers welcome policy. We replaced it with a 4 cores or go-home rule, then bumped that to 6 cores, then 8. It didn't matter. Out in the real world of retail hardware, they were shoving cores into cheap-ass consumer hardware so fast, we could afford to monotonically raise the bar for donations and still never run short. We ran it against the salts used for well-known Wi-Fi routers and produced tables that we uploaded to cheap cloud storage, clearing the hard drives for the next round. Password hashes for major OSs, hashes for embedded systems, photocopiers, keyless entry door locks. Theoretically, the manufacturers could have made these much stronger, but they weren't thinking ahead to the day when three weirdos might build themselves a cluster that could grind ceaselessly through the whole universe of A to... Now, this is an author's note. I've written the letter Z 1,000 times, or Z for you Americans. And after a while, the cluster got big enough to recompute against any new salt in pretty short time, especially with our information about the most common passwords. We were pretty self-congratulatory, I must admit, very proud to have outthought all those silly engineers and product managers. Of course, none of us had the foresight to imagine that the day was coming when you could replicate our work for $12 worth of time on a cheesy cloud house in Bulgaria or some other exotic place. No, we were too busy forming an order of knights. Knighthood? Tracy and Tristan looked at me like I was insane. I felt my chin jut out at a belligerent angle, and I reeled it back in. It's either that or a League of Superheroes. Look, with great power comes great responsibility. We need a moral compass to ensure that we use our powers for good. We need chivalry, a code. Now, superheroes are cool and all, but Justice League of the Rainbow Table isn't nearly so cool as Knights of the Rainbow Table, is it? We'd been building up these enormous tables, and theoretically we hadn't touched them except to try them out on our own tame little test files. The reality was much more sordid, of course. I'd made a project of cracking the WPA passwords for at least 2 routers in every place I frequented, so that I could use them as I roamed the city. And once I was on them, well, it was only natural that my curiosity would compel me to play sneaky peeky at the traffic on the network, snaffle up some email and tweets and Facebook nonsuches. Not that there was anything worth looking at. I could play Rear Window all day and night, and the most sordid thing that I'd find was a little tax cheating, some unimaginative dirty talk, people losing their tempers at each other and snorting and steaming like Yosemite Sam without any capital letters or the benefit of spell check. But I couldn't look away. At first, it was the horror of how naked it all was, the sheer volume of unencrypted credit card numbers, login credentials, and assorted personally identifying information. PII, the smog of the 21st century, ubiquitous and impossible to be rid of. Even after the shock of other people's technologically naive vulnerability wore off, I still looked because I couldn't look away. I'm a monkey. I'm descended from monkeys. And the monkeys I'm descended from beat all the other monkeys by figuring out how to work together. And the secret to that is keeping track of all the other monkeys to make sure that they're not sleeping in a tree while you're gathering the fruit. I couldn't not look away. If you could, well, you're a better monkey than me. Me too, Tracy admitted. The kids next door are really creatively vicious about some other kid at school. A girl who picked on them that they've been quietly sabotaging for weeks now. Lots of fake social network stuff, imaginary boyfriends asking her to send topless photos, the whole lot. It's like a car crash with a side of child porn. So icky, but I bet you can't eat just one. Tristan blushed and looked down and looked up and looked down. My neighbor's got a bunch of IP-enabled CCTVs in his house and he picks his nose and I can't look away. Look, it's not the locks that keep you from breaking into your neighbor's house, right? I mean, any of us could figure out how to pick any lock in about a day, right? It's ethics, social contract. It's a belief that the nobility of doing right and doing good and doing unto others and all that. A million daycare workers who told you to share your toys, no punching, don't eat off that other kid's plate. I've been up all night tossing and turning about this, in between watching an insomniac somewhere on my block get into a vicious Wikipedia edit war over the history of Glock semi-automatics with an intensity that made me suspect that he had a basement full of the things and had spent a lot of time contemplating what he might do with them. What I'm saying is, here we have all this power, and if we want to be a force for good, well, that won't happen automatically. We've got to have something, something substantial and, you know, formal, if we're going to steer clear of being creepy evil voyeurs. Creepy evil voyeurs, Tristan said. It's a term of art, I said. Yeah, the peril of CEV beckons, Tracy said. So why not a knighthood? After all, isn't that what knights were all about? We've got swords and armor and training, and we could theoretically go around beheading and disemboweling willy-nilly, but instead we'll develop some sort of formal code that we'll all abide by that specifies exactly whose head we're going to remove and whose bowels we're going to dis. What's wrong with not disemboweling altogether? Tristan said. He was a pacifist at heart. Tracy crossed her eyes at him. You're joking, right? Once you got swords, you can't not have swords. Are you going to take apart the shithouse? Just the thought of it made my neck and shoulders tighten up like a tennis racket. No one's going to shut down the cluster. Of course not, Tristan said. He looked even more scandalized than me by the thought. All right then, talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the U.S. under seal of copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.